This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Circle of Life Hospice offers compassionate end-of-life care and bereavement support, serving patients in their homes, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and throughout Northwest Arkansas. Circle of Life provides freestanding inpatient hospice homes in Springdale and Bentonville. When it comes to hospice care, choices are available. Ask for us by name.
The Fayetteville Foam Fest will be held this Saturday from 5 to 8 p.m. in the Walton Art Center parking lot in Fayetteville. This Feed Fayetteville fundraiser will feature craft beers and tastings from over 250 breweries, food, live music, and more. Tickets are limited. More information available online at FayettevilleFoamFest.com. And later on the show, we will announce how two lucky listeners can win tickets to Foam Fest.
Ahead on Ozarks at Large, we meet a couple that has taken the spirit of their late daughter and turned it into an organization with her same essence. A fundraiser next week will benefit Olivia's Basket.
Plus, 28 years in the making, the Arkansas-Missouri Railroad has been named the 2014 Regional Railway of the Year. And we talk economics with Roby Brock and more.
But first, damage estimates are still being calculated in the wake of Sunday night's tornado, which was confirmed yesterday by the National Weather Service as an EF4 tornado. Insurance companies are sending agents to Valonia and Mayflower to help file claims. Kyla O'Brien with Allstate says dozens have been sent from her company alone.
There's local people that live in Arkansas that have come and are helping out, auto adjusters and property adjusters, but we also have a special team that deals with these kinds of disasters, and they came here as well. We have the mobile claims center adjusters that are here in Valonia.
O'Brien says they're acting to contact every single customer they have in the impacted areas.
Our adjusters are going out into the areas with this list and this map, checking on our policyholders, going door to door. If the roads are blocked and the vehicles can't get through, they're going by foot and they're checking on our policyholders, see how they're doing.
O'Brien says claims have ranged from relatively minor shingle damage to entire properties being destroyed. She says as more roads are cleared, more people have come through their mobile claims center stationed along Main Street in Valonia.
Entergy Arkansas says 670 linemen, many from outside the area, are working to restore power for its customers in the Mayflower, Valonia, and Ferndale areas. Spokesman David Lewis says it will take some time to rebuild its infrastructure.
In a concentrated damage area like with a tornado, you can actually fit only so many workers in there at one time. So we saturate.
Lewis says poles were snapped, transmission lines were down, and distribution equipment was greatly damaged by Sunday's tornado.
On one hand, they're just another blow from nature that we are accustomed to dealing with. On the other hand, their own kind of problem. They're very concentrated, and the destruction is severe where it hits.
Lewis says the challenge is the limited amount of space in the areas impacted by the storm.
Center in Springdale is getting closer to collecting the $30 million it needs to create an endowment to help run the center. This morning, the George family from Springdale pledged $1 million to the Jones Center. Gary George is the chairman of George's.
We're here to support the Jones Center, a great place for all the families to come and in Northwest Arkansas and the surrounding area. And Harvey and Bernice left this for this area, and they're on a campaign to raise an endowment, and we wanted to be a part of that, give back to the community.
We'll have more on what this announcement means for the Jones Center's future on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large.
While FEMA officials are urging Faulkner County residents and business owners affected by tornado damage to file an application for federal aid, the Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration says that the county's taxpayers will be given special tax relief because of the storm's aftermath. According to Talk Business Arkansas, agency officials yesterday said it will extend taxpayer deadlines to file tax documents and will avoid charging interest and penalties related to state taxes if failure to pay as a result of storm-related issues.
A local student has taken the first prize in the 23rd annual Preserve Our Past Art and Essay Invitational Contest, which is sponsored by the Department of Arkansas Heritage. According to the department, Duncan Gwynn, a homeschooled student from Siloam Springs, won first place in the 5th and 6th grade essay division for writing about the town's healing springs. Works that took the top three places or honorable mention in the contest will be on display at the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center in Little Rock for the rest of May. May is Arkansas Heritage Month.
More people are using public transit in Northwest Arkansas. According to Ozark Regional Transit, fixed route ridership was up 17% in April when compared to last year. In total, the Transit Authority logged an average of 1,153 daily passengers during the month.
Beginning today, a portion of Duncan Street in downtown Fayetteville will be closed. According to the city, the street will be closed between Center and Treadwell Streets through mid-September.
Walmart is planning on testing another new store format in Bentonville. According to the City Wire, the retailer is in the preliminary planning stages of a standalone grocery pickup center where shoppers can drive up and retrieve online grocery orders without even leaving their car. Bentonville city officials reviewed plans for the first concept depot Tuesday, and the proposed development goes before the city's planning commission next week. If approved, the 15,000-square-foot facility will include 10,000 fresh and dry grocery products and be located near the intersection of J Street and South Walton Boulevard.
Fort Smith-based Arkansas Best Corporation has a new name today. Yesterday, officials with the transportation holding company announced that it is rebranding as ARC Best. That's ARC with a C. According to the company, the branding change was designed to enhance the company's identity as a holistic provider of transportation and logistics solutions. While the company's stock ticker symbol has changed to ARCB, all but one of its subsidiaries will retain their original names. The only exception is Datatronics, the company's information technology division, which is now named ARC Best Technologies.
Forecast calls for mostly clear skies tonight, with overnight lows from 36 in northwest Arkansas to 41 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Friday, sunny with highs from 69 to 75 degrees. Tomorrow evening, mostly clear with lows in the mid-40s. This is Ozarks at Large. Last month, the unemployment rate fell below 7% for the first time in 5 years. Dr. Michael Paco is UALR's chief economist with the Institute for Economic Advancement, and he has also been a research economist at the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis. Paco told Talk Business Arkansas's Roby Brock that Arkansas has been on a roll the past 6 months.
Let's talk about what's been happening with employment and unemployment in Arkansas. Very interesting, really, when you look at the last 3 to 6 months. We had this magical barrier that we seemed to break through in the March numbers that came out. Unemployment below 7% for the first time in 61 months, more than 5 years. How significant is that? And is that number, 7%, something symbolic, or is it meaningful?
Well, the number itself is really symbolic, but the trend you're referring to is something real, and is, we really appear to have turned the corner. You know, as the data were coming in a few months ago, it was becoming increasingly apparent that we were really stuck in a rut here in Arkansas. The unemployment rate was in the range of 7.5%. Payroll employment was going nowhere, really from about the summer of 2011 through the summer of 2013. But the past 7 months, really the breaking point was last August, we've seen a sequence of very positive employment reports. The unemployment number of unemployed has come down every month since then. The number of employed has gone up. Cumulatively, the number of employed is up over 16,000, and the number of unemployed down 10,000. And of course, the unemployment rate has come down from 7.8 to 6.9%. So that really is a breakthrough in getting out of that rut that the Arkansas economy appeared to have been in for a couple of years there.
But now, despite that improvement over the last 6 months, we're still not near where we were prior to the recession and some of the problems that we had in the years subsequent to that.
Yeah, unfortunately, in terms of payroll employment, we've added some 37,000 jobs since the trough of the recession, so we're making progress. But we're still about 17,000 to 18,000 jobs short of where we were when the recession began. And of course, the labor force population has grown since then. So in order to really get caught up to where we should be, we're still a long way away from getting there.
Is it possible that we're not tracking all of the data that could be contributing to the employment numbers in the state of Arkansas, in that there's a lot of startup and entrepreneurial activity anecdotally that we hear about, that we see? That's not necessarily reflected in those numbers, is it?
That's always the source of some uncertainty, is that when new firms are coming into play, those new jobs aren't necessarily initially reflected in the jobs numbers. They get picked up eventually, but it's one of those sources of revisions in the data. Also, the payroll numbers don't capture the number of self-employed persons. So if people are starting up their own businesses, hanging out the shingle on their own, then we might not be picking that up in the immediate data as well.
Let's flip a conversation that's going on at the state and national level right now is raising the minimum wage. We've got a state minimum wage effort. There's been some push nationally for a federal minimum wage effort. Those are two different initiatives. What's the impact of raising the minimum wage? Does it help put more money into the economy in terms of consumer spending? And does it, I guess at the same time, does it also hurt employers who are not going to hire because of higher wages?
Well, you know, minimum wage laws are popular because they're well-intentioned, and you can see the direct benefits. They're pretty clear. But as an economist, I think it's really incumbent upon me to look at the costs, both the hidden costs and the explicit costs. And I think one point you raised is that the money just doesn't come out of the sky. It doesn't grow on trees. That when you end up transferring money to minimum wage workers, it comes from somewhere else. That could be in the form of higher prices for the products we pay for. It could be lower wage increases for other workers. It could be less hiring of other low-skilled workers. And that's one of the problems that economists often focus on, is that if the minimum wage is increased, it prices very low-skilled workers out of the market in the first place. And these are the young, inexperienced workers who are just trying to get their foot in the door, trying to get a start in the job market. And those are the ones who are most likely to be adversely affected. And you know, you look at the unemployment rate among 16 to 19-year-olds, many of the recipients of minimum wage jobs, that's 1 in 3 are unemployed right now. Among those are even looking. So it's not really a demographic that we want to hurt even more.
Dr. Michael Paco is the chief economist at UALR's Institute for Economic Advancement. He recently spoke with Roby Brock, with our content partner Talk Business and Politics. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.org.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at aecc.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at arkansasstatechamber.com.
In the final quarter of this edition of Ozarks at Large, how merely moving someone off of a dirt floor and onto a concrete slab can decrease their chance of disease and sickness by over 50%.
When a family is living in a tent or a hovel or something that can't be locked up, can't be guarded, someone has to stay with their possessions. That prevents a family member from going to school or from working. Day-to-day existence limits your ability to invest in the future nutritionally in your family, educationally in your family, socially in your family. By providing a house, you are in a way literally providing a way for them to now start thinking about the future.
We visit with the founders of Olivia's Baskets, an organization that helps to build homes in Mexico and Honduras. That's still ahead on Ozarks at Large.
Coming up on Thursday, part 2 of our chat with the new PT Young Artist in Residence, violinist Robin Bollinger. Robin will play a piece that she calls a heartbreaker. It's the melody for violin and piano by Tchaikovsky. Robin Bollinger, our young artist in residence, on Thursday's Performance Today from APM.
Listen tonight at 8 to 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. Kindergarten, it isn't what it used to be. Due to programs like No Child Left Behind and Common Core State Standards, there's a trickle-down effect of pressures on higher grades into the lower grades. Daphna Bazak is an assistant professor of education policy at the University of Virginia. She researched and co-authored a paper, Is Kindergarten the New First Grade? The Changing Nature of Kindergarten in the Age of Accountability. Bazak recently visited the University of Arkansas campus to deliver a speech on the subject, and she stopped by the Carver Center for Public Radio. She says she went into her research by looking at to what extent has kindergarten changed over the decades.
For the last century, kindergarten has existed, and when it began, it wasn't as formally recognized as part of a school system. And so it was kind of a process for kindergarten to join what was the first to 12th grade system. Now we say K-12 as though, of course, kindergarten would be included in it. And so it's changed over time. And there have been a lot of questions about what the role of kindergarten is and what we're trying to get kids to learn in there. So whether it's around just basically learning to socialize and learning to interact with other children and discovery play, or whether there should be more of a focus on specific skill building.
You don't trace kindergarten all the way back to the last, for 100 years. You really just look at 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, so we actually are looking at a very short period. In the paper, what we did was compare what kindergarten looked like in 1998 to how it looked in 2006. And in part, we were looking at this short period because it kind of straddled a time when accountability pressures increased, where there were No Child Left Behind came into place, and also just a lot of other pressures around literacy at the elementary school level. And so we were trying to test the hypothesis that as schools have been more focused on accountability, kindergarten has changed over time. And we just wanted to see how much has it changed. Is that something that we kind of just have in our, is that a narrative that we have, or has it really changed substantially along concrete dimensions? So we look at things like, what do kindergarten teachers believe today relative to what they believed then? How are they spending their time? What does the curriculum look like? How much focus is there on assessing kids in literacy and things like that?
You mentioned time, and I remember there being, you know, half-day kindergarten. Some kids would go in the morning, some would go in the afternoon, and you did half-day kindergarten.
Right.
Is it full day?
Yeah, so there's been a very large increase over the past two decades in the likelihood kids are going to school for a full school day. And so when we started the study in 1998, it was roughly half of kids were going to full day and half of kids were going half. And then over a pretty short period of time, it went up to about 70%, and today it's closer to over 80% of kids who are going to kindergarten for the full day. So you're much more likely to have kind of a 8-to-3 experience than just a short 3-hour experience relative to what it was a couple decades ago.
And it's not all fun and games.
So I think
a full day of...
It's a full day, and I think what we find is that there is a real thrust to the curriculum around literacy in particular. And so what we did in the study is look at how kids are spending their time as reported by kind of a large nationally representative sample of kindergarten teachers. And what we saw was that there was a substantial increase in the amount of time that teachers said they worked on literacy. So time on literacy in a week went up by about 25% in this period. And lots of other things went down. And so we see pretty substantial drops in the likelihood that kids are learning art, music, drops in their exposure to physical education. We see drops in the amount of time teachers report doing just kind of child-selected activities where the kids are choosing what they would like to work on, and even drops in science and social studies. So really a shift in kindergarten towards really a literacy-oriented experience. And even when we looked at what teachers report about their expectations for kids. They're saying, in the more recent period, they're saying kids should really come into kindergarten already knowing their letters and their numbers and their shapes, and that's really in contrast to in 1998, where kindergarten teachers more thought that that was something that kids could learn while they were in kindergarten.
Well, I recently saw, you know, somebody had posted a video of their two-year-old on Facebook, and the mom was drawing letters, you know, and saying,
sure.
Well, what letter is this? And the two-year-old, he could recognize all of these letters.
Kids are curious, and they can learn things, and they love to learn things, both in literacy, math concepts, science concepts. They're inherently curious, and they can learn a lot more than we might anticipate. And so I don't think it's necessarily an issue to have high expectations for kids and to want to expose them to a lot. Part of why we're seeing these changes is because we spend a lot more time on the learning experiences of very young kids. You know, I had talked about kind of pressure from above to change kindergarten, but I also think kids are coming into kindergarten in to a large extent with a different set of skills than they were in the past. We have a ton more kids going to preschool than we did before, and so I think in part kids just know more at the beginning of kindergarten than they did in the past. I think the concern about our findings is more around how does this focus on literacy and on academics look in practice, and is it done in a way that is stressful for kids? Is it done in a way that makes kids anxious about going to school, or is it done in a way that's fun and engaging and kind of meets five-year-old children where they are?
What I guess concerns me is that kids aren't able to be kids, maybe. Are they kind of losing that time where they can be curious and, you know, and be a kid?
So I think that's a great question, and I think that's kind of the concern that people come to the trends in kindergarten, and that's what they're worried about, that we are stressing kids out too early, and that really some of the benefits of early childhood educational experiences aren't about learning specific letters or numeracy. They might be more around discovery and figuring things out on your own and just having fun and interacting and learning that way. I think we tend to make kind of the mistake of pitting being a child and being playful and then academics being on the other end as inherently not childlike and not playful. I mean, I think that when it's done right, you can have classrooms where kids are learning a ton and also it's very playful and they are not feeling like, oh, we are sitting down to do a lesson and it's not we're handing out worksheets over and over again. It's just that the learning experiences are embedded in what they're doing. So I think it's important to acknowledge that you can do both in a very effective way. I think the challenge is that teachers are under an immense amount of pressure, and oftentimes probably what ends up happening due to the pressure, due to the focus on literacy, is that it does become more of a stressful environment for kids and is about worksheets and is around kind of just paying attention and sitting still and listening to things more than many five-year-olds might be happy to do.
You did mention that in the use of time, that time spent on physical education, on PE, is going down. And in this day and age, we hear a lot about childhood obesity. You know,
sure.
Michelle Obama has launched initiatives for healthy eating in our schools. So less time, you know, when you know, it's a crucial age.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was, from our findings, one of the most troubling ones to us, just because we didn't have a great measure of time spent on recess, so we weren't able to compare kind of free time altogether. But we thought of PE as something that has been shown in the literature, both because of its impact on health outcomes and obesity, but also to have a great impact on kids' ability to focus and their ability to learn and their cognitive development. So if kids have time to run around and have that physical experience, they come back into the classroom more engaged. And I think any kindergarten teacher that I've talked to has said these kids need to have some time to run around and play. And so the drop in that was probably the most troubling, because it seems like there is a real crowding out of things that help sort of develop kids in a holistic way.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned No Child Left Behind. This year, you know, Common Core State Standards will go into effect in 45 states. You know, and those are standardized tests. And right now there are no tests for kindergartners. But how are they being assessed? And will these standardized tests trickle down to kindergarten someday?
So already in the data that we looked at, which was not even that was pre Common Core standards, we see a really large increase in testing at kindergarten. And so we see that in 1998, in the survey that we looked at, they didn't even ask the kindergarten teachers about how much testing they did. They only asked the first grade teachers, presumably because that didn't even seem like a question you would ask a kindergarten teacher. Do you do standardized testing? In the later data, we see that the kindergarten teachers today are spending more time on standardized tests than the first grade teachers were back then, in that it's really been something that has been immersed into the classrooms. And I think it is something that can be really potentially stressful. I think with all these things, it comes down to what are the standards? How good are the standards? Are they things that we think are helpful for kids learning? And I think that the Common Core standards for early childhood, there's been an effort to be pretty broad in thinking about how do we think about kids' exposure to numeracy and how do we think about those things in a way that's broad and focused on more critical thinking and the kinds of thinking that a five-year-old is actually capable of, and less about just specific facts and teaching kids to memorize things. So I think that there is a lot of emphasis on improving what it is we're asking of kindergartners, but it does crowd out a lot, and I think, you know, you hear a lot from kindergarten teachers.
I know that here in Fayetteville, I mean, our listening area is much more than just Fayetteville, but I know here in Fayetteville, I believe two of the elementary schools in the public school district have pre-K programs. So someday, is it going to be, you know, it's K through 12 now, but someday, is this going to be pre-K through 12?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in lots of places, that's where we are already. I mean, there's a huge emphasis on expanding access to high-quality preschool, the role of universal preschool, and in some states, that happens largely through the public school system. And so I think that in the same way that kindergarten over time was sort of immersed into the public school system, I think in lots of places, that's happening with pre-kindergarten as well. And I don't think that's inherently problematic if you keep in mind that developmentally, kids are in a very different place when they're 3, 4 years old than when they are 6 or 7. And you have to keep that in mind. You have to have instructors who have their training in child development and kind of understand what children's development looks like at that age and how to cater the instruction to that group. I mean, I think that where we get nervous is if you think about just kind of this focus on certain kinds of instruction, pushing out kind of a more holistic approach to young kids.
Well, so as somebody that is expecting my first child, and I mean, I'm already concerned with their education, him or hers, should I be concerned if at 2 they don't know their alphabet and they can't recognize letters, or if at 5 they can't read, you know, an entire children's book?
I think absolutely not. I mean, I think that obviously there's a wide range of abilities. You know, when kids are 2 years old, the range of skills that kids have is huge. And you see parents getting so stressed out about, oh, well, I saw, you know, my neighbor's child or my sister's child do this and my child can't do that. And that really isn't taking account the fact that kids just develop at different rates and have different kinds of strengths. And obviously, lots of us went into kindergarten and preschool experiences that weren't focused on some of these skills and have turned out perfectly fine. I think kids learn at different rates. I think that it's a mistake to create an environment of stress around what very young children know, and you want to mostly be focused on having them enjoy learning and like going to school and want to be there and want to be a part of that program. At the same time, I think that there are lots of low-income families where the exposure to literacy and math content is very, very low. We know that exposure to these concepts is really important. We know that kids who get exposure to more words or get read to a lot or get exposed to math concepts early end up doing really quite a bit better later on. And I think that because there is kind of a huge disparity in exposure to those kinds of materials across socioeconomic status and different kinds of homes, I think it is kind of becoming more infused into preschool programs and kindergarten programs to try to provide that experience for kids.
Daphna Basak is an assistant professor of education policy at the University of Virginia. She recently visited the University of Arkansas campus to speak on the subject, Is Kindergarten the New First Grade? This is Ozarks at Large. We'll be right back.
while sitting on a patio at one of the many restaurants located near Dixon Street in Fayetteville. It's not unusual to hear the sound of a train passing by. The Arkansas and Missouri Railroad runs through much of Northwest Arkansas, and earlier this year, Railway Age magazine named the A&M Railroad Company the 2014 Regional Railroad of the Year. The award was presented at the American Short Line and Regional Association's annual meeting, which occurred last week in San Diego. Riley McCarron, chairman of the A&M, was on hand to receive the award last week.
It is extremely gratifying to be recognized in that way. It's a little humbling, too, to be honest, because there are 500 and some odd short line regional railroads in the United States. You know, but our folks have worked very hard for what will be, well, it's already 27 years, it'll be 28 years on Labor Day, you know, to build the A&M into what it is today. And, you know, for them to earn that recognition is really wonderful.
The A&M was established in 1986 as a Class 3 railroad that operates from Monett, Missouri to Fort Smith, Arkansas, and its corporate headquarters are located in Springdale. The main line includes about 140 miles of track, and McCarron says there are about 10 miles of branch lines. According to an article by Railway Age magazine, the Springdale-based railroad company has upgraded its mainline trackage and clearances to allow for higher speeds and double-stack container trains, while modernizing its locomotive fleet and locomotive shop. McCarron says last year they bought 3 new locomotives, and this is just one of a number of projects the A&M has completed or is working on.
Our sister company built a Ozark Transmodal, built a 60,000-foot warehouse extension in Fort Smith last year. This year, we're working together with one of our customers to up in Butterfield, Missouri, to build a terminal that will handle both grain and also construction sand. We'll move some of that activity up there to be a little closer to our customers.
The A&M provides freight service and interchanges traffic with 3 Class 1 railroads, Burlington Northern Santa Fe, Kansas City Southern, and the Union Pacific, as well as the Fort Smith Railroad. According to the A&M's website, all lines are rated at 286,000 pounds and cleared for double-stack rail cars, and main lines feature continuous welded rail. Track Superintendent Larry Rouse has more than 4 decades of experience in the railroad industry, and he is one of the people who helps make sure things run smoothly for the A&M.
I come from a railroad family. Parents had worked on the railroad. My grandfathers had worked on the railroad. And I guess it's part, they say it's in your blood.
Because of the constant use, parts of the rail, of course, need to be replaced from time to time. Because of the curves and hills in the area, Larry says the rails have a tendency to wear out sooner than he would like, but he says you just have to get into a routine of replacing the rail every so often.
It depends on your tonnage that runs over and the curves, the degree of your curves. You're probably looking at, if you get a 10 to 15 years of some lifespan of some rail. You know, today, you know, years ago, they was just regular steel. Now they have a head-hardened steel where it's hardened. You know, technology has come a long way since I first started. I mean, it changes almost daily. You know, things, it's like the everything else in the country. So you got to keep up or you get lost.
In addition to delivering freight, the A&M also operates passenger train excursions. Larry's wife, Brenda, is the operations manager for the passenger train, and she has been with the railroad for 14 years. She says when she first started, the excursion train ran 6 months out of the year and carried about 6,800 passengers. They now operate year-round, and last year, she says they transported 40,000 riders. Much like other parts of the A&M's operations, the excursion train is also undergoing some changes.
Over the last year, we've just acquired a new Vista Dome, which was part of the California Zephyr train. And 2 weeks ago, we just got another new car in, which was part of the Texas, the Spirit of Texas, the Sunset Special. And it is a dining car, and we're in the process of getting it remodeled and getting it ready to put on the rails.
Brenda says they have 7 train cars now. Regular excursions include trips from Springdale to Van Buren and from Van Buren to Winslow. During the winter, the railroad often has special holiday trains as well. Brenda says this fall, they will introduce some Razorback train excursions. She says they have worked out some dates with the city of Rogers to run a train from Rogers to Baum Stadium in Fayetteville for a few of the November football games. She says this will be the first year for this trip, but they have been talking about it for years, and it's the extra equipment they have that is allowing them to finally organize the trips this fall. Brenda says they are always looking for something different to add to their offerings.
People are looking for different venues and things like that. You know, when I first started, we did a lot of leisure group travel, and we do a lot of group tours, but now we're kind of tapping into the corporate market to where you can also have training on the train, group meetings. We've done a lot of weddings, birthday parties. We've had a couple shotgun weddings, surprise shotgun weddings over the mountain. Just always looking for something different to add.
Another new event for the A&M is hosting the National Railway Historical Society's annual convention June 10th through the 15th. Brenda says this is the first time Arkansas has hosted the event. June 14th through the 15th, Amtrak's historic exhibit train will be in Springdale for a free display featuring a specially painted locomotive to commemorate America's veterans, as well as displays showcasing the history of the nation's intercity passenger railroad. Information on the convention is available at nrhs.com. For more on the Arkansas-Missouri Railroad, visit amrailroad.com.
Next time on Ask Me Another, Peter Sagal, the sheriff of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, recalls a showdown in his family's grocery store.
Because I'm me, I'd have a little bit of dialogue with the yogurt. So, I told you never to come back to this dairy section again.
Join me, Deputy Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's guiltiest and most puzzling pleasure.
It's Ask Me Another, and you can listen Saturday at 11 a.m. to 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Safe water ensures good health and quality of life. The Beaver Water District, a member of the American Water Works Association, and its partners monitor and protect Beaver Lake, the drinking water source of Northwest Arkansas. Drinking Water Week is May 4th through the 10th. Consider pouring a glass of water and hailing a toast to Beaver Lake. You drink it every day. More information available at bwdh2o.org.
The Rogers Historical Museum presents Family Day, May 17th, from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. This event celebrates Hog Wild, our area's love affair with the pig, and will include a piglet race, petting zoo, hog calling, and more. Located in historic downtown Rogers, this Family Day event is free and open to the public. 621-1154 or rogersarkansas.com/museum for more information.
Still ahead, the founders of Olivia's Basket introduce us to their late daughter, Olivia, the inspiration behind the nonprofit that helps to build homes in Mexico and Honduras.
But first, International Migratory Bird Day is celebrated in Canada, the United States, Mexico, Central and South America, and the Caribbean. Hobbs State Park will celebrate this day tomorrow with a variety of family-oriented events, including live falcons. Activities include birds and breakfast, bird hikes, an afternoon cruise on Beaver Lake, and a live falcon demonstration. The Hobbs State Park Visitor Center is located on Highway 12, just east of the Highway 12 War Eagle Road intersection. More information available by calling 789-5000 or visit friendsofhobbs.com.
Also at Hobbs State Park, Saturday there will be a presentation about the good, the bad, and the ugly of Benton County, Arkansas. Leah Whitehead, president of the Benton County Historical Society, will explore some of the good and not so good characters in our unique Benton County history. Governors to claim jumpers to the last legal hanging in the county, Whitehead will expose many interesting aspects of an impulsive and sometimes explosive Benton County past. The public is invited to the free program, which is a continuation of the Friends of Hobbs monthly speaker series. For more information, 789-5000 or friendsofhobbs.com.
At the very beginning of the show, we announced that Fayetteville Foam Fest will be this Saturday in the Walton Arts Center parking lot.
It will.
Tons and tons and tons of beers. The event benefits Feed Fayetteville.
It does. And you pay, I think it's $40 to get in. You get to try all sorts of beers. It's from 5 to 9. I always enjoy these types of events because I like to try different types of things, because there may be some types of beer, for example, that you might like, but you may not like, and you hate to pay for an entire glass of that at a bar. So this is an excellent way to kind of try different types of beers and support a local charity at the same time.
That's right. And I know the tickets are limited to this event. Mm-hmm. So now is your chance, our listeners' chance, to win two pair of tickets to Saturday's event.
Yes, we're going to have two winners, and each winner will get a pair of tickets. All you have to do is email us your name and your number to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com, and we will select winners tomorrow.
Right. We'll announce those winners on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. Again, two pair of tickets, two winners to Fayetteville Foam Fest. Email your name to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. It is Thursday, the first day of May, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And with us now is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Do you remember the Wednesday secret?
Ooh, Sound of Music.
At the Arts Center of the Ozarks.
Yes.
Okay, here's the Thursday secret.
All right.
The theater season for the University of Arkansas, which is now the theater department, not the drama department. Michael Rhea is at the end of his first year as department chairman, and he says that he wants it to be shouted from the rooftops that this is where great talent starts. And he's really not kidding. They do amazing things. This year they're opening. They're trying to put more focus on bringing your kids. So this year they wrapped up the season with As You Like It, which was 90 minutes and very family friendly. They're starting the fall season with Godspell.
Oh, that's a good one.
Absolutely love mm-hmm. that show. Mm-hmm. And that's a very family-friendly show. That starts October 3rd. The second show is called Kin. It's going to be directed by Amy Herzberg, and it's about an Ivy League poetry student from Texas who falls for an Irish personal trainer. Okay. And then there's all sorts of family hilarity and drama.
Is the personal trainer's name Ken?
I don't know. It starts November 7th. They're doing another classic comedy, The Foreigner.
Oh, yes.
I love that show. It's the story of a guy who takes his friend to a country lodge for the weekend. He tells him his friend doesn't speak English. So everybody tells the friend the secrets. And it's really funny. Directed by Michael Landman, who's also really funny. That's in February. And they wrap it up with Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard in April, directed by Kate Frank. You can find out about tickets at 575-3645 or email drama@uark.edu.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
As Northwest Arkansas has grown, so has the variety of nonprofits operating in the region. Olivia's Basket is unique. In the past 5 years, the Northwest Arkansas-based organization has built 9 new homes in 3 locations, in Mexico and Honduras. They work with Homes of Hope to identify locations and families meeting qualifications. And then, with under $8,000 and about 15 people over the age of 15 in 2 days, weather permitting, build a new home. Tuesday, Olivia's Basket will have its first ever public fundraiser. Eat, Build, Love, at the Garden Room on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums recently talked to the creators of Olivia's Basket, Jane and John Ray, about Olivia's Basket. Jane Ray explained the organization's namesake is their daughter, Olivia, who lost her life more than 4 years ago.
I describe Olivia as the best of all of us. She was outgoing, intensely creative, and she was the kid on the playground that if she saw someone not playing with anybody, she would go over to them and play with them. And in light of that, to create an organization that simply helps other people is kind of perfect.
It's interesting to respond to grief. I mean, because we've been in the ministry for a long time, so we've walked with other people through this. And oftentimes there is an intense desire to try to create something to hold on to the memory of a person. We were really fortunate and really blessed that it was stuff we were already doing. You know, I had been on a house build that summer with Olivia. She jumped up there and, you know, grabbed a paintbrush and painted a little bit and then would play with a dog or play with a kid and run around and help hand stuff up. So it was stuff that we were already doing. It was stuff that already expressed where Olivia was and what she was involved with. So this there was such a tremendous outpouring of grief and support from the Fayetteville, Northwest Arkansas community that we already had this avenue there. We just kind of created the project of Olivia's Basket around that to capture that.
A little bit under $8,000, about a dozen to maybe 15 people, 2 to 3 days.
Right.
Yes, we start at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, and hopefully by 4 o'clock the next afternoon, we're handing those keys over.
And if the weather holds.
If the weather holds, good point on that. And there's not a system at the end of this build, but just to slightly describe it, it's this. The keys are given to the family. They're the first people to enter their own home alone. Then, maybe, 10 minutes after that, we knock on the door or somebody, and then they open the door, and we're the very first guests that they have. And it's a cheer. Everyone is happy and laughing, and I know that there's a TV show where they say move that bus, but this is bigger. Yeah. Every single person is affected, and the neighborhoods involved as well. It's a remarkable thing to experience.
You have stories on at oliviasbasket.org about the people who have moved in and what it has meant and what it can mean for a family that's struggling, and now they have shelter.
Right.
And so much, it's exponential what can happen after that, instead of struggling just to find out where you're going to live.
Well, the statistics are overwhelming when you consider, just take health for an issue. You cut the chance and incidence of disease and sickness over 50% merely by moving someone off the dirt onto a concrete slab. So you've increased their health by half overnight with that. The ability to think generationally. When a family is living in a tent or a hovel or something that can't be locked up, can't be guarded, someone has to stay with their possessions. That prevents a family member from going to school or from working. Day-to-day existence limits your ability to invest in the future nutritionally in your family, educationally in your family, socially in your family. By providing a house, you are, in a way, literally providing a way for them to now start thinking about the future that they did not have before they had it.
At the Garden Room, there is a benefit.
It's the first benefit we've ever had. We reached a point last year where we approached our family, our kids, and we said, okay, are we going to keep doing this? And without hesitation, every one of our daughters said, absolutely, we really, really want to continue to do this. And that's when we said, it's time. It's time to blow it out and make it bigger.
Yeah, because up to this point, the generosity of Northwest Arkansas and the way that they have carried us, the churches, the friends, the Leverett PTO has been unbelievable. And we really haven't had to ask for a lot of help financially. But we understood, you know, things change. It's been 5 years and coming up this fall. And so we knew that we needed to raise some funds, but we also wanted to do something so out of the ordinary. We wanted to do something very different than just put on a fundraiser. And Jane probably speak to that, what our vision is for that.
This is personal to us. So when we approached this, it needed to be who we were, who we are, essentially. We wanted it to be, again, personal, intimate, and extraordinary. And the way that we knew to do this was to make it around some really good food, which creates really good conversation, which creates an atmosphere where when you leave, you feel invigorated and honored and willing to say, I want to do more. That is the entire hope of the evening, just so that people leave going, this is an extraordinary thing.
Well, you have a special chef.
Yes, we do.
I feel this is a personal acquaintance as well.
Well, so oftentimes, look, we go there because there is a tremendous level of poverty. That's where we're building houses. But we're also, we're not going down there just because there's a problem that needs to be fixed. Our heart, to a large degree, is in this area. It's an incredible culture. It's a rich environment. And the history, the food, the people there, we consider some of our closest friends. And Ismine, we met her through a mutual friend. And Jane will tell you, when anyone comes up and starts talking about food and they place their hand on their heart while they're speaking of the food, we're won over. And so we got to be friends with her, and I wish she was here to tell the story. We became friends, and then she lost her father and went through a very difficult time. And through hearing our story and knowing what we had been through with losing Olivia, we really connected. We really bonded. And it's one of those just incredible, special relationships. She's one of the top chefs in Baja. She's working in the Valle de Guadalupe, which is just an area that is exploding with the food and wine scene down there. And she's one of the recognized leaders in that scene there. And so for her to close her restaurant, which is on her mom's vineyard, and to come here to Fayetteville for a week is a significant sacrifice on her behalf. I mean, it's when we came up with the idea and then she said yes without hesitation, honestly, we were a little bit taken aback. It was something that, wow, she would really do that for us. So we can't wait for her to get here, and think that it's just having her in our home and taking her out to meet friends and do things is special enough.
Do you know what the menu is going to be?
No, because
she's going to be using locally sourced food, right?
And honestly, for us, that is a thrilling thing. We have consistently reached out to the different vendors in the farmers market, from meats and poultry, everything, have sent her that information so she can start to possibly gather something together. There's also a contact with the four James Beard nominated chefs in Bentonville, and they too have enlisted, saying, this is who we use, etc. And she's hoping, we're hoping that she can just sync up and meet them when she gets here.
John and Jane Ray are the creators of the nonprofit organization Olivia's Basket. The fundraiser, Eat, Build, Love, is Tuesday night at the Garden Room in Fayetteville. Tickets are limited to 100 seats. For more information about the fundraiser, eatbuildlove.com, and you can learn more about Olivia's Basket at oliviasbasket.org. The Rays talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this week.
The Community Creative Center Visual Arts Organization offers a variety of mixed media arts classes and workshops for all ages and skill levels. Located inside Walton Art Center's Nadine Baum Studios in Fayetteville, the Community Creative Center is hosting Locally Unique, a spring pottery and art sale this Saturday. 571-2706 or communitycreativecenter.org for more information.
Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
Support for KUAF comes from Westwood Gardens, offering a variety of Westwood-grown annuals, perennials, and hanging baskets, and an online plant finder. More information available at westwoodgardens.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM Fayetteville.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thank you so much for listening. Have a good Thursday.